Welcome back to Hash Right Up. Back on the show today, Nico Smith. I sat down with Nico Smith to talk about the Q1 2024 mining review that he's put out, all the graphs, all the values, all the metrics around Bitcoin mining in the first quarter of this year. And then we also spoke about what's happening in Paraguay. Stay tuned. All right. So as I said in the introduction, I'm back with Nico Smith. Hello, Nico. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
This is Hash Right Up. We're with Nico. We're talking about Paraguay and the first quarter of mining metrics that he's put out, both of which you can find in his newsletter or the latest releases of his newsletter. We are at block height 838763. Our 30-day hash rate is at 606.5, and the hash price currently sits at 113.45. So, yeah, a couple of days before the halving, 9 days,
yeah,
pretty much.
Less than 10, yeah.
9 days to go with that sweet, sweet above $100 hash price, and then it'll be chopped in half in a couple of blocks here.
Let's see what happens.
What hash rate do you use typically, Nico, for your reports? Which one do you focus on?
I usually use a 7-day moving average. I know you like the 30 days. It's less volatile. But if I do an analysis each 2 weeks on mining economics, like it's more interesting for me to look at the 7 days.
I think I might actually switch to the 2 weeks because of the difficulty adjustment. I don't know. I feel like there should be some synergy there or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
Nico, what I want to get into first is Paraguay and what's happening down there.
Yeah,
the industry is a bit nervous, being shaken up by bills that are being passed around. I've seen PDFs fly around, pictures, and from here on a different continent, it's kind of hard to really get a feel for what's going on the ground. I've never been to the continent, never been to the country. And I know you are right now. Where are you at? Are you in Argentina?
Yeah, so I live in Buenos Aires. I'm Dutch originally, but moved here over 2.5 years ago. So I live in South America. I've traveled all over the continent for my previous job. And yeah, I went to Paraguay 7 times over the last year and a half for mining-related business. So I have quite some insights. I don't have all the insights. Then you really need to live there. But still actively working there.
So I think what would help is to give people a bit of background on mining in Paraguay itself and sort of when it started and how and who the big players are and all of that stuff. Do you want to just go into that a little bit for me?
Sure. Yeah. So Paraguay has become kind of the mining center here in South America over the last few years. The biggest reason why a lot of miners come here is because of the abundance of energy. There's a big hydro production. So 99.9% of production in Paraguay is coming from hydro dams. The most famous one is the Itaipu Dam, which produces 14 gigawatts. Paraguay shares the dam with Brazil. It's a 50-50% ownership, but it's the second biggest dam in the world. It produces 7 gigawatts for Paraguay, but then in the south, there's two more dams, one that produces 900 megawatts and another one that produces 210 megawatts. Paraguay is relatively small, so there's 7 million people living there. The people that live there don't have a lot of resources, right? So they don't consume a lot of energy. And then next to that, Paraguay is landlocked, so it doesn't have access to the sea. And therefore, there's not a lot of heavy industry or manufacturers that that go to Paraguay. So there's little competition for that power. And that has appealed to many miners. Recently, ANDI, which is a state-owned entity and the power generator and distributor in Paraguay, they stated that they have 680 megawatts of contracts running at the moment with miners.
Active.
It's contracts that are active. I know there's some build outs going on in that list. There's also Bitfarms, for example, and they have a 70 megawatts facility that's in construction, and then a 100 megawatt contract that's also still in development, but it's 680 megawatts contracted, which is quite big.
Can we do me a favor? Let's go back a little bit. Itaipu, what is the connection with Brazil there, and also the political dimensions? Because I understand.
Yeah, so Itaipu
industry.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Itaipu is a binational project, so it's co-owned and co-operated by both countries. It was built 50 years ago, or 51 years ago, I believe, this year. And Paraguay, for the largest period, they had a big debt with Brazil that they had to pay off because they couldn't finance that dam at the time, right? And that debt to Brazil has been paid off last year. Was the last payment. So there's been a lot of negotiations going back and forth. Right now, they sell power as low as $10 per megawatt. So that's 1 cent per kilowatt hour to Brazil, which is below production cost, let's say. And Andy, that state-owned power provider, has around 2 gigawatts of pending requests for power from miners. And what the government does is they use those pending contracts as leverage towards Brazil to renegotiate or to get higher prices for their power, let's say.
So the miners are actually willing to pay more. All right. So, and what you're saying is the industry is now at a point where it has gained significant size and can actually, the politicians can use Bitcoin mining industry to drive up the market price for that power. Is that what you're saying, essentially?
Yeah, they use it as leverage in a negotiation with Brazil.
Okay.
The biggest part of the miners are on the high tension side. Over 500 megawatts is on that high tension, 220 kilovolts. They pay $39 per megawatt, so that's 3.9 cents. The miners that are on the medium voltage side, they pay even a bit more. So compare that to the $10 or to the 1 cent per kilowatt hour, and significantly more that they can make from miners or by selling power locally.
Okay, when did mining in Paraguay really kick off?
When it started, I don't know, but when it kicked off, I think last year it really got into it accelerated. 2022, 2023, and now that will continue to 2024.
All right, and then you mentioned Andy. Andy is the utility, right?
Yeah,
the electricity regulator.
So that's a state-run power generated distributor, or they do transmission distribution. And then there's one private player which is called CLIFSA. CLIFSA buys power from Andy. Excuse me, I have a little bit. CLIFSA buys power from Andy. They have a contract that's in place for a long time already, like in the 60s, I believe. All the utilities were nationalized except for CLIFSA. So they pay 1.6 cents per kilowatt hour to Andy for that power, and they have some miners on the contract as well. The exact amount, I don't know. There's some private miners in there, but Bitfarms also has 10 megawatts contracted with CLIFSA.
Okay.
So on top of that 680 megawatt under Andy, there's also mining going on under CLIFSA, which might be, let's say, 20 to 30 megawatts, my estimation. And then there's a lot of illegal mining, right? So there has been a big crackdown by the government, but there's still a lot of illegal activities going on, and that's actually also causing the troubles in the grid.
What do those look like? Can you give some examples?
Yeah, so illegal mining is not just power theft. So there's some smaller players maybe that that steal power, but there's also a big part that's illegal, which is corruption, right? So they pay off employees of Andi to get access to power. So yeah, a big part of the problems there is that. Sorry, I'm having a cold. So the big part of the problem there is that no grid studies are being done. So power is being consumed where sometimes a grid cannot handle it, and then it causes blackouts. And those blackouts has been very have been occurring quite a bit last summer. So the pressure on the grid was big, and therefore people started complaining, and the politicians had to do something, and that's where this bill came from also.
Okay, all right, but again, let's keep on the illegal mining train. All right, so you're saying it's not just people stealing power from the grid or corruption. What about the different tariffs? Because I understand there's also people using tariffs from and then mining on them, which they're not actually supposed to do. Like, what does that look like in practice, and how does the government figure that out? You know what I mean?
You mean the illegal mining?
Yes.
Yeah, so how they get to the tariffs, I'm not exactly sure. I can imagine that they pay off somebody of Andi and then negotiate a certain price. That I'm not so fully sure how that works. But they do get low prices, let's say, because they pay off the people.
And is Andi in general, would you say, apart from the corruption, reliable utility, or is it completely lackluster and there's people privately fixing lines all over the place?
No, so yeah, there needs to be investments done in the grid, obviously, this corruption has been fought also from within Andi. So there's been a big crackdown on illegal mining activities over the last 6 months. So they are working on it. But the bill that came out proposed a mining ban for 180 days. That would mean switching off the legal, formerly contracted miners. And that doesn't make a lot of sense, because you'll be punishing those that bring in revenues. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the illegal miners will stop their activities.
Okay, but hold on. Again, I'm hearing different angles from all over the place, right? Because it's a very chaotic situation. Government puts out a paper, there's signatures on it, and all of a sudden the whole industry jumps up and it's like, what the hell is happening? So it does affect also the people who have been doing everything above board and cleanly. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of outages over this summer, mostly caused by illegal miners, and that has moved politicians to take action, right? The government has been trying to regulate the industry already for a while. There's been various bills thrown around, but none of them have made it to law. The crypto mining industry in Paraguay has a significant impact economically, but also with these power outages through illegal mining. So action needed to be made.
Yeah, I mean, you already said there's a lot of revenue to be lost there if they will go through with this. Now, you know, you look at Canada, you look at New York. There's moratoriums for Bitcoin mining because of what is written in newspapers, you know, so it politicians don't always act rationally. Do you know what the political landscape in Paraguay is right now? Is it more left-leaning, more right-leaning? What are the sort of major influences? Yeah. Who is president? Like, what's their opinion? Do you know?
Yeah, so I don't know all the details about the politics there. I do know it's more right-leaning. So the current president is a businessman also, but I think if you compare it to maybe what happened in Canada or New York, in Paraguay the crypto mining industry does have a significant impact and is also one of the few off-takers of power right next to the neighbors and the rest of their own economy. So I think the impact is much bigger in Paraguay than in Canada. Like Canada, if they ban mining, they won't feel much if you look at the broader economy, let's say.
Okay. Is
and so, I, yeah, maybe to add to the revenue, right? So next to the revenue coming from power going to Andy, which is state owned, there's also VAT being paid over the power, and then there was also this research done that 68 million in import tax was collected over the period of 2020 to 2023. So it's also the importation tax and VAT that that brings in revenue for the government.
Let's talk about importation. What is the import tax on ASICs? Do you know?
Yeah,
I heard 25% somewhere around that. And I think, and I'll tell you what I know.
I have to,
I'll tell you what I know. I heard that, okay, look, there's 25% import tax. Again, please, if anybody knows in the comments for sure, please write it down. It's not low, but then it always depends on what these ASICs are worth, right? And so as we've seen, and on the last show that we recorded, we went into that, the ASIC price index, the prices for ASICs, they fluctuate. Not as much as the Bitcoin price does, but it does fluctuate quite heavily. So the question is, the import guys, the customs employees, they don't know, right? And so it's always about how much value do they put on these miners?
I think they do know very well. They do know. So customs in Paraguay, they're not stupid. They know what's in those boxes is very valuable. We need to fact check this, but what I've understood is that import tax is around 16%. But so it's a bit lower, but still it's significant. What I've heard from importers is that batches of miners come in, customs sees these pallets and they know what's in those boxes. They know it's of high value. They know there's a lot of money to be made there. And then they take prices from the internet from a while ago or different pricing than the value that it stated on the invoices. So sometimes they value it higher and there's a negotiation and then they agree on a certain value. I think it's a challenge, but also there's a responsibility on the exporters importer side, because if you import your ASICs at a ridiculous low price, which also happens, right? So the invoicing price is way lower than the value of the miners. Then you're asking for trouble, let's say. While if your price or the value on your invoice is fair, then you're less likely to run into to trouble.
What do those negotios look like on the ground?
I have no clue. Like I haven't been there, but I would recommend if and it's even needed, you need to work with a Paraguayan importer in order to get your machines in. So they need to have the import license. So if somebody says we can send it with DHL, don't fall for it. Your miners will get stuck at customs, and then you pay a bigger price, let's say. So,
and
work with somebody that has.
What does it take to get the miners out? Is it
payment?
Yeah, what kind of payment? Like illegal, like corruption payments to the customs officials, or does it take export tariffs? Because a lot of people refer to Paraguay as a prison for your ASICs. Once they're there, they don't leave the country, or they just be traded internally.
I think that's somewhat true. I don't know if it, like that statement maybe also has to do with the cost of getting your miners out again, right?
Yeah.
As I said, Paraguay is landlocked, so importation costs are not low. So once they're there, if you want to send them back to the States, let's say, that's costly. And if you ship them, it's timely. So it doesn't make a lot of sense. If you want to ship them out of the country, I would say find an alternative within the Mercosur. So maybe go to Brazil or to Argentina, because there's agreements about importation with those countries.
Okay. All right. Let's maybe talk about Brazil and Argentina in a bit as alternatives while we stay on this topic. The big players in Paraguay right now, is that Marathon and Bitfarms, or are there any other publicly listed companies that have operations?
Yeah, so Bitfarms, they have a 100 megawatt contract in Iguazu, that's near the Itapu Dam. And then they have 70 megawatts in the area of Villarrica. So that's a significant player, right? Marathon, they have their miners operated at the Penguin Group. They have a 100 megawatt contract and it's another big player. There are a few bigger contracts over there in Paraguay. Marathon doesn't own any contracts or a local infrastructure. At least on the high tension side, they have their machines operated by the Penguin Group.
Okay. If you had 100 ASICs right now, Nico, and wanted to send them to Paraguay, how do you get them operating?
So currently that's very challenging because the government had this big crackdown on illegal mining. There are a lot of machines floating around and there's rack space lacking, right? So currently it's very challenging to find rack space. The government has created this new crypto rate, which is a higher rate. So in order to connect to the medium voltage tension, you pay a higher fee, and it doesn't really make sense to set up a hosting business, let's say.
Okay.
There are also older contracts. So companies that acquire other companies that already have all the contracts in place, there you have better rates. But these older contracts are getting scarce. So I would say at this moment, the biggest opportunity in Paraguay is when you go for a bigger contract and you invest in a substation, there you can get access to lower rates. But it's a significant different investment than sending 100 ASICs.
No, of course. Okay, so this is why, you know, mining is, a as much as we like a decentralized big capex game, so bringing a lot of miners gives you a lot more access and access to cheaper rates, right? And that's all about the cost per kilowatt hour.
So maybe in the future there, sorry to interrupt you, but maybe in the future there will be opportunities again. But right now, like I said, there's the crackdown on illegal mining. A lot of miners flowing around looking for rack space, a lack of attractive rates for new companies. So there's this pressure cooker, let's say, or bottleneck in rack space, which might be resolved when big investors come in and start developing rack space again.
What if you have miners there and, you know, they were imported, let's say, semi-legally? What are the story there around paperwork, having the proper paperwork in place for the imports for these machines and stuff like that? Can it cause you problems if you don't have it, if the machines are used and you're shipping them from one facility?
If you go through customs, you'll get your importing papers and... if you have the right papers, then you can get them out easily. There's also smuggling. So there's people that smuggle ASICs over the border. Then you don't have the correct papers. And then it's hard to get them, harder to get them out. I would always recommend to go the legal route. It sounds scary, but there's if you know the right ways to go, then... then there's no problem getting your miners in.
Okay. Do the larger players have influence on politics? You now said they proposed a 180-day mining ban that would shut off everybody.
I saw that Bitfarms was already lobbying. So they've been talking to politicians. Also, I understood that various miners came together and they're funding a renew bill. So, yeah, they're the miners are lobbying. There's also some contracts that are being owned by families that have a lot of influence, right? So rich families that have an interest in the mining business, and they have political influence. So I don't think this bill will pass without any resistance from formal miners and also from influential families within Paraguay.
Yeah, because from what I understand, there's already another development now where they actually want to make it legal and give it a proper rate, precisely because of what you said earlier, right? To compete with
So the Senate approved a declaration in which they stated that they want to attract foreign investments and local investments into the infrastructure and sell the excess power. Right. So, I think the proposed bill made a lot of noise. It will continue to make a lot of noise, but that in the end, this mining ban of 180 days won't be taken in effect. That's my expectation.
Maybe it's also, if you want to put the tinfoil hat on. It scares a lot of people that are mining illegally if something like that comes out, or that are working with people that maybe have other rates or whatever. And then, a lot of people jump up and maybe make moves that they shouldn't, because now they feel the pressure and the heat building up. So you think it doesn't pass? What is next? It has given Ethiopia even more of a limelight, or made the limelight on Ethiopia even stronger as sort of an alternative to Ethiopia with the cheap rates.
Yeah, well, I think in any non-Western market, you're running certain risk, right? So what's happening in Paraguay might happen in the future in Ethiopia. I would say miners that are looking at Paraguay, I would say Paraguay will be a secondary market or somewhere to diversify into. The same goes for Ethiopia. So if you have your facility set up in the States or maybe in Scandinavia, a more stable jurisdiction, then it might make sense to diversify into these riskier countries. For local investors, obviously, it's a different case. For Paraguayans themselves or South Americans, Paraguay is not considered as risky as it is by Western miners.
Yeah, no, that's always the perceived risk. Right? It's a subjective approach. What about Brazil and Argentina, Nico, mining there? What's the development there?
Yeah, so Brazil, I know not that much about. I think Ather Mining is one of the more well-known in the space. They are mining in Brazil. They also have facilities in the States, I believe. Argentina, I know a bit more about because I'm based here. Argentina, because of the previous government, has been very difficult for miners. Before Milei, the libertarian that's being welcomed by Bitcoiners, before he was president, there was a very socialist government here. Very protectionist, so a lot of import tax, high import costs, quotations, right? So limits on the amount of products that could be imported. So yeah, mining in Argentina has not really taken off hugely because of that, because the business climate has been challenging. However, there is quite some mining going on in Vaca Muerta, which is a big petroleum and gas reserve in the south of Argentina. You have a lot of flared gas mining going on there. Cusoe, which is a big company, has set foot there. And also recently, Giga Energy announced that they started in Argentina. they are collaborating with an Argentinian entity. So they're putting their foot in the door. So on the flared gas and stranded gas side, there's opportunities. And hopefully with the new government, yeah, things will change. There's a lot of policy changes, but the dust still needs to settle. And hopefully in the second part of this year, yeah, Argentina will rise as a mining hub, let's say, in South America.
Amazing. Nico, let's talk about Q1. Do you want to share your screen and we get into
your
content? Nico, why is there a dog on the front page of your slides?
Yeah, so I put a dog there because those that are in the Bitcoin mining industry and even in Bitcoin know that Bitcoin years are like dog years. So everything that happened in Q1 2024, yeah, you can compare to a full year in any other sector. So that's why I put a dog on there.
Love it.
So I'll go through different indicators for looking back to Q1. Obviously, Bitcoin price is very important for miners. We all know that it's been a very bullish quarter. We started the year at 42K and ended the quarter at 72K. So that's about a 70% increase. Very bullish. We broke all-time highs in the beginning of March and reached the highest point of this year, of this cycle, at 73,800 on March 14th. We saw one big drawdown percentage-wise in January of 21%. And then currently the retracement that we're seeing, or the pause in the bullish price action that we're seeing, when that started, we were at that all-time high and dropped to 60,800. So a nominal drop of $13,000, which is significant. But I guess these bigger price drops we'll see more and more as Bitcoin price increases, right? The drawdown percentage-wise up till now have been very mild if you compare it to the previous cycles where we saw minus 30 or above 30% decreases. So the 20% decrease is not that bad. Looking at the performance month over month, we see that March was also closed in the green and that there were seven consecutive months in the green, which is actually a match of the longest streak of consecutive green months that we saw in 2012. So it's very significant what has happened over the last 7 months, that they were all closed in the green. So if April closes in the green, we'll see a record even of longest streak. Something significant also that happened is that Bitcoin surpassed silver in market cap. I think this is it's fun to share because Bitcoin is often seen as a store of value, like metals, like silver and gold.
Can I just say,
yeah,
gold has not always been. I've seen this chart before. Gold has not always been on top, has it? That also.
But it might be, but well, there's a big gap with Microsoft. So depending what's in this list.
Yeah, I guess yeah, that changes. You're right. I mean, there's a huge gap. You're right. I didn't see that before.
Yeah, but my gold obviously has been on the rise also.
Mm.
And also NVIDIA has been on the rise. So here it's at number four. I believe it's at number two in this list already. But yeah, Bitcoin surpassed silver, flipping silver, let's say. But still, there's a huge way to go before we flip gold.
Yeah, Google is next.
We need another...
Google is next.
Yeah. So we'll be on the hunt for the next.
Do you know that meme of the death knocking on the doors? 36K.
Yeah.
That's what's going through my mind right now. Google, Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah. So looking at quarterly returns, Bitcoin really performed very well if you compare to other assets. This is a nice chart by NIDIG. I think NVIDIA might be the only only stock out there that outperformed, so one of the few stocks out there that outperformed Bitcoin. So this puts it in perspective that Bitcoin really did a great great job in performance.
Yep.
This price increase obviously has been driven by Bitcoin holdings by the ETFs. The ETF approval was in January, so not too long ago, even though it seems long ago because of those dark years. But in that first quarter, over 835 Bitcoins were added to these ETFs or holded by these ETFs. There were nine Bitcoin ETFs that were new, let's say, next to the GBTC funds. And these nine ETFs added over 500,000 Bitcoin. The biggest holder of Bitcoin is still GBTC, despite their big outflows. There was a lot of outflow, mostly going from GBTC to these new new ETFs, because these newer ETFs have lower fees.
Yeah,
it seems to be slowing down at the moment, but GBTC has seen quite a bit of an outflow. IBIT is the ETF of BlackRock. So after GBTC, they are the biggest holder. They at the end of the first quarter had 252 Bitcoin on their balance sheet.
That's ridiculous.
And after, yeah.
I mean, hold on. When did BlackRock start? Was it in January?
January.
And they already have 11, more Bitcoin 10, than 11. MicroStrategy in their wallet.
That's, yeah.
And how long has Michael Saylor been pushing and promoting his strategy? Is insane.
Well, yeah, that was the last bull market already, right? So 2021.
Yes.
MicroStrategy did add 25,000 Bitcoin to their balance sheet.
Yeah.
So it is still a very significant player, but BlackRock has been growing very quickly, and if they go, they continue this pace, they will surpass GBTC this quarter. That's what's my.
They'll make MicroStrategy look like Tesla on this chart.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah, but I think BlackRock does have a bigger buying power because of the it's not all their own funds.
No,
right?
Of course,
MicroStrategy has to.
It's not a fair comparison by any metric, but it's just baffling to me that how quickly seeing this,
yeah.
You know, shows you how quickly it's been growing, which is insane.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, you see Tether here with the 66,000 Bitcoin. As I think that's very impressive. I mean, that they're a crypto native, right? So MicroStrategy is not crypto native, let's say. So I think it's very impressive to see that they have 66,000 Bitcoin at the end of quarter one. They added 8,000, I believe, also in
Are you familiar with Tether? Can I ask you a question, or you're not too versed?
You mean mining-wise, or?
No. Just from a treasury holding standpoint. Like how much of, because they have to back their USDT, right? And I assume that's part of their treasury.
Yeah.
There's other stuff in there. But do you know how much of their treasury, or how much of the backing is done through holding BTC? Like what percentage of their total?
So percentage? No, I have no clue.
Okay.
No, we need to look that up.
Yeah, I'll look it up.
Good question. We'll have to look it up.
Okay.
But Tether has been involved in mining as well, right? So they invested quite a bit in mining and deployed quite a bit in South America also. So they have a big project in Uruguay, in Salvador, and I believe some mining in Paraguay, but not fully sure there. But they diversify by next to treasuries, also invest in Bitcoin and mining.
Yeah.
So looking at the network hash rate, so the computing power of the miners in the first quarter, we started the year at 511 exahash, closed the quarter at 586 exahash. So there was a total growth of 75 exahash or 14.7%. This is an equivalent of 375,000 of the latest Antminers S21s, 200 terahash. We saw an all-time high on March 11 of 631 exahash on the seven-day moving average. And that's also the level where we are currently, I believe, last time I checked.
Okay.
So this increase in hash rate was caused for a big part by this deployments of the latest ASICs, the most efficient ASICs, like the S21s that are sub 20 joules per terahash. But what is interesting to see is this is a chart by Coinmetrics. They measured the estimated network efficiency. So despite all these new miners sub 20 joules per terahash coming online, the network efficiency did not improve. It even got worse. So it went from 30.75 joules per terahash to 31.37 joules per terahash.
How is this measured, not what you... Nico? Sorry to interrupt you. How is this measured? Where do you take the overall consumption from?
They have a study about the nonce. So this is something you have to check on Coinmetrics. Maybe they are a good guest to invite me on the next show. They did this whole study about the signals that ASICs provide on the network, nonces, and that helps them to, or that way they can determine what kind of machines are operating online. And taking those machines, they can calculate the average hash rate.
It's moments...
efficiency, sorry.
Yeah, it's moments like this where I wish I would know what's going on in China and Russia, because culturally that's just a space that's completely... blocked off and I don't have access to it. I hope that changes after going to Bitcoin Asia and Hong Kong next month. But those inefficient ASICs have to go somewhere, right? We know that. But
yeah, so I think a conclusion here is that, or a conclusion that we might draw is, that less efficient machines came online. And I think that has to do with profitability, right? So the we'll have a slide on profitability later on the hash price, but with Bitcoin price rising, the margins improved, and it made sense to put less efficient machines online again.
Here's what I'm thinking on that. I think rack space is scarce, right? And if everybody's replacing the inefficient ASICs before the halving with S21s that we've just seen, I would love to look at that nonce analysis and see how it changes, or it changed over the last four quarters. You know, did everybody really replace their inefficient ASICs, or did they have rack space additional? Did they build more? Like, that would be very interesting.
I think when you say everybody, it's also like the public perspective, right? So you have these public miners announcing big purchases of these latest models. So it's not everybody. Not everybody has the means to keep on buying the latest ASICs. So it's also a perspective, maybe. But also, if you look at XP, for example, it takes quite a bit before a new machine has a significant contribution to the overall network.
Yeah.
So it takes time to deploy. What is interesting to see is that you see sometimes machines like the XP, before they came to market, they were already signaled on the network. So that's, I guess you can say, manufacturers testing their machines.
Extensively. Testing them extensively. Yeah.
Well, you need to know how much hash rate they produce before you can categorize them. So that was that's interesting to see, like these signals or nonces being identified while the machines are not even at the market. So yeah, some big headlines over the last quarter, or the first quarter of this year. Obviously, Swan announcing that they started mining. Yeah, big surprise. They surprised a lot of people, right? They had 4.5 exahash already online when they announced it. And very, very few people knew about it. I think as I saw a tweet of Corey the other day that they are already surpassing 7 exahash. So it's really impressive how they've been deploying. And then there's also been some companies going public. Grid Infrastructure went public on the NASDAQ, and the same goes for Gryphon Digital Mining. Also BitFuFu, which is a cloud mining service very closely tied to Bitmain, the biggest ASIC manufacturer. They went to the NASDAQ through a SPAC merger. And then Corn Scientific has risen from the depths. They had their refinancing, their restructuring done, and they relisted their shares on the NASDAQ. And then here you see a picture of Ethiopia, a dam in Ethiopia. I think a big headline in Q1 was the Ethiopian government announcing that they're investing in or they signed an MOU to invest in Bitcoin mining.
Yeah, I did.
Chinese players making their moves.
I did a show. I should maybe do an update because now that so much has happened. I did a show with Nemo Semret on mining in Ethiopia, who actually went and acquired one of the first PPAs. So that was a good show if you want, anybody wants to go and listen back to that.
I think it's very interesting to follow. I mean, there's a lot of potential, as you know, in Africa. And if Ethiopia does it well, it might set an example for other countries.
Yep, 100%.
All right, so going to difficulty. Well, as hash rate has been on the rise, so as difficulty, we started at 72.0 trillion and went to 83.13 at the end of the quarter. So a 15.4% increase in difficulty. The highest level was reached on March 13th at 83.95 trillion. And we saw 4 difficulty increases and 3 downward adjustments. But as you can see, the upward or the increases were outpacing the downward adjustments. Yesterday we had another increase, and it was the last difficulty adjustment before the halving. So we're now in the last epoch, difficulty epoch going into the halving. Hash value, so this is the amount of Bitcoin you can mine per petahash per day, which is influenced by the block subsidy, currently still at 6.25. Transaction fees and then difficulty obviously has an impact on this. We started the year at 0.002 Bitcoin per petahash per day and went down to 0.0156 Bitcoin per petahash per day. So a 22.8 decline. You see a few small spikes. Those were spikes in transaction fees, but overall, the trajectory of hash value has been following the difficulty adjustment in the first quarter. So hash price is the amount of dollars you can earn per petahash per day. This is like hash value influenced by block subsidy, block or transaction fees and difficulty, but also by Bitcoin price. And as transaction fees have been quite numb, you can see that the hash price has been following the Bitcoin price for the bigger part of Q1. We started the year at $89 per petahash per day and closed the quarter at $108 per petahash per day. So a 21.3% increase. And the highest point we saw was 120 petahash per day.
On this chart in blue is hash price and in yellow is Bitcoin price measured in dollars, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Yeah. So you see that it follows quite closely. Then going to transactions, this is the mempool. Here you can see all the pending transactions, and there was a good clearance of transactions. Sorry, in February, which is positive, obviously, if you are looking to do transactions on the base layer as transactions become cheaper. But getting rid of this congestion also means that less fees are being paid, and miners benefit less from these fees. If you look at the transaction fees and you ignore the big spikes here, you can see that overall it's been going down. It's a downward trend throughout the quarter. The spikes you see look significant, but they are not that significant. Like in January, we saw a big spike to 9.3 million. But if you compare that to the highest price point or highest transaction fees in December, there they were at 23.7 million. So way less transaction fees in this quarter.
Okay, so let me just clarify for the viewers. In black is the cumulative line since all time, and this is the...
No, black is the price. Black is okay. A Bitcoin price.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. Let me see. Then we go to the transaction fees as a percentage of block reward. Here you see those big spikes in November, December, and those have been dying off, let's say. So now we're at the same level as we were in October. The daily miner revenue was very interesting to see. It increased quite a bit in Q1 because of the increase in Bitcoin price. And we even reached an all-time high of daily miner revenue at almost 80 million revenue on a daily basis.
Wow.
That is surpassing the all-time high of the peak of the bull market in 2021, where it was at 73 million on a day.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously here we're not at the Q1 anymore. This is now December 2020 to November 2023.
This runs through that peak that you see is in March 2024.
Okay.
So this is zoomed out.
Yeah.
So that peak happened in that first quarter. We started that quarter at around 50 million,
mm-hmm.
and ended it at 73.
Mm-hmm.
But we saw that big spike around the Bitcoin all-time high at 83 million. Many believe, including me, that we're not at the peak of the bull market yet. So it's a record that's going to be broken again, I guess, in the near future. Yeah. So then going to the ASIC market, ASIC prices. Last time we spoke, we already saw this decoupling, right, between Bitcoin price and ASIC prices. Where before the ASIC price really followed the Bitcoin price, as of 2023, ASIC prices kept on sliding and Bitcoin price started increasing. The first quarter of 2024, this trend kind of continued. ASIC prices were mostly flat, while the Bitcoin price has risen significantly.
How much longer until?
And then if,
until these ASICs just go flipping vertical.
I last week I spoke to Alex at Kaboom Rex. Kaboom Rex is an ASIC reseller in the States, and his expectations. I mean, these guys have a good insight into the market, right? So his expectation is that ASIC prices will tank even further after the halving. Because many secondary or secondhand miners will hit the market, but also expectation is that if we reach that parabolic that last phase of the market and all the machines are absorbed, right? Then prices will rise again. Whereby obviously the the most efficient machines will start rising in price first, because they're the most sought after.
Yeah.
And the supply is least. But then I expect that the S19 J Pro will have a similar trajectory. If we go back, a similar trajectory to the S9. So I see the S9s are not included in this, but the S9s were kind of given away for free pre-bull market in 2020. And during the bull market in 2021, they rose in price again. So I expect the same with the S19s, which are the biggest part of the network. So they will become even cheaper, and at a certain point when mining becomes crazy profitable again, then demand will increase and everybody will be buying ASICs. Mm. So yeah, I would say if you have ASICs that become unprofitable, you don't need that money right away, hold on to them and wait a few months and then sell them instead of selling them right after the halving. So what's interesting to see is that when we reach that all-time high in Bitcoin price, if you compare it to the previous all-time high in November of 21, we now have more hash rate purchasing power, right? Because the price of the ASICs are down. So now you can get a S19 for $12 per terahash, let's say. Well, before or at that previous all-time high, it was 105. So with a budget of $100,000 back then, you could buy 9 units of S19 J Pros, 100 terahash. So not even 1 petahash. And with that same budget, you can buy 83 of these machines at the moment.
Does it buy you a larger network share than back then? What would you say?
I believe around that time we were at 200 exahash, maybe.
So and now it's 6. So definitely, yeah.
It's again an interesting question. I'll
add it to the next one in Q2. I wanna see that. Like, you know, obviously, because that's what matters. How much of the network share would that represent? And if now for $100,000 you can get 3 times the network share than you could get in back then in 2021, that's a significant difference, right?
Yeah. But it just shows like the different states we're in while we're reaching this all-time high in Bitcoin. Mm. Right.
Yeah.
Let me see. Yeah, so some big headlines in the ASIC market. On the top left, you see Charlie Schramm and his business partner, very happy with the first ASIC that they put to the market. Back then, the machine was running at 65 gigahash, so that's 0.065 terahash. So very low computing power if you compare it to now, more than a decade later. But at the time, they were mining 25 bitcoins a day with that machine.
Throwback.
So it's just, it's just crazy how things change, right? If you look at the efficiency, like it was a crazy low efficiency, but they increased the efficiency improved the efficiency by 50x by introducing the ASIC to the market. And then the comparison. Or the contrast, let's say, Bitmain announcing in Q1 the S21 Pro, which is a machine that produces 234 terahash and runs at 3,531 watts. So that's 15 joules per terahash. This machine will be launched in November or in Q3, of 2024. This 15 joules per terahash is a 14% improvement if you compare it to the S21 that runs at 17.5 joules per terahash.
It's always interesting to see what it actually does on the rack when it's installed.
Of course, there's this. It's almost becoming a meme, right?
For a reason.
You can have have a very low or a very good high efficiency, low joules per terahash. But if they're not running, how efficient is your machine? Another string on the interesting headline was the announcement of Bitdeer, of their SEAL 01 4 nanometer chip. So they're looking to produce an ASIC that has 18.1 joules per terahash efficiency.
I'm trying to have them on as well. Yeah. I had Auradine on, and this is another announcement that they made today. I think they raised another Series B, or they raised the Series B round of 80 million to develop their ASIC hardware, which is pretty crazy after the first Series A.
That's Auradine, right? Yeah. That did that race. Yeah. Well, it's needed. It's if you want to be competitive in that market, it's very costly, the research and development, and then trying to compete with a player like a Bitmain that has 75% or more market share, let's say. Okay, so you also asked me next to the review of Q1 to look forward a bit. If we look at into this glass ball of glass crystal ball, I'd say, of hash rates for Q2, I think it's interesting to look back at what happened during previous halvings. If you look at hash rate, we saw significant drops in previous halvings. The last one in 2020, there was even 25% of the hash rate coming offline. Now we're at 630 exahash. So if we would see a similar drop of 25%, that would mean that 157.5 exahash would come offline. This equals 1.57 million N-minus S19J Pros, or equivalent of 4.7 gigawatts going offline, right? So that's enormous. Something I find hard to imagine. It might happen, but I think this time around it's also different if you compare it to 2020. I think some major differences between now and the previous halving is that the industry has grown a lot. It's become more sophisticated as well. So miners are now able to mine in low power mode, making their machines more efficient. So I can imagine that many miners, instead of switching off directly, they will go into low power mode, make their machines more efficient, try to stay profitable for a longer time before they phase out those miners that are not profitable anymore. Also, what's very different from the previous halving is that we hit an all-time high before the halving, right? So in previous halvings, we saw a delay between the halving and price increase, or price marking a new all-time high. So that really changed the margins right now, might impact cause a less of an impact on hash rates. Also, what we saw in the bear market in 2022. Is there a lot of miners that went bankrupt? their rigs stayed online, right? So they kept on mining while they're being while they're refinancing or being acquired, merging with others. So I can imagine also after the halving in Q2, maybe companies go bankrupt, but they don't switch off. They keep their miners running while they're being acquired or while they're refinancing the business. I think also what's different to previous halvings is that we've seen some transaction fee spikes last year, and this might be the case around the halving as well, as there might be competition for block space to inscribe ordinals into this block space, and people are willing to pay a price for that, let's say. So my expectations for hash price in Q2, right now we're quite close to the halving. We're around $110 per petahash per day. So if the halving would happen now, will be around that $60 per petahash per day mark. This is a chart of Luxor. It's their hash rate forward curve, and here you can see what the market expects hash price will do. So,
what do you expect? Over or under 60 in August?
Yeah, July. I think a bit over, a bit above 60 because of this. If transaction fees start spiking at the halving, because of these unique blocks, we might see a bit higher hash price.
I think structurally, there's an argument to be made that in the next coming quarters, we will go towards 80 again, just simply because of what you stated in the beginning, all of those inflows to Bitcoin and it being so much easier to dump fiat money, to dump dollars into Bitcoin and buying Bitcoin and pushing up the price is a lot easier than plugging in hash rate. Right. So at least that's my belief. I don't know, maybe I'm thinking too simply about this, but like I can't see a world in which hash price stays subdued because miners are quicker in plugging in machines than investors or ETFs are putting or allocating funds to this.
Yeah, so you at previous cycles you see that at certain point price outpaces a hash rate deployment, right? But I think even if we hit this level of $59 per petahash, it's not a very bad scenario because we've seen these levels last year, even in October, I believe. And the lowest hash price historically we've seen in 2022, November 2022, when it was around $55 per petahash per day. At previous halvings, you saw hash price marking a new record low in hash price. So if we don't do that, it's already much more positive than previous halvings.
Yeah, agreed. All right.
Yeah. So maybe one more point, the break-even hash price. Making scenarios of where hash price might go is one part of the equation, but then looking at your miner fleet, what's your efficiency, and then calculate what your break-even hash price is important. So here I took three different models, the S19J Pro, the XPs, and the S21s with different efficiencies, right? And then I looked at the different hash prices per hash cost. So a hash cost is the electricity price plus other costs, right? So many publish these models based on electricity price. But next to your electricity cost, you also have personnel to pay. You have maybe a lease on your on your property,
yeah,
or an interest rate to pay on your on a loan you took out. Depreciation of machines. So that's all taken into account with hash cost. If you're paying a hosting fee, like a straight up hosting fee without revenue share or whatever, then that's similar to the hosting hash cost. So looking at that S19J Pro, you can see that the break even is interestingly enough around that $58.5 per petahash per day when you're mining at 8 cents. So I would say as long as you're at 8 cents or lower, then your S19 J Pros will be safe after the halving. Yeah,
and this is why, you know, people approach you and me when they want to get started mining, because we understand to look at this and how to advise people on this, right? So if you are thinking about getting into the game after the halving and you don't really know where to start or where to plug in your miners, where to put them in Paraguay, US, Ethiopia, Argentina, Russia, China, wherever you want, there's different risks associated with it. And then probably Nico and I also have different views on risk reward and all of that stuff. So, and since, you know, Nico runs Digital Mining Solutions, I run HashRedUp. we're objective, right? I mean, I can speak for myself, you speak for yourself, Nico, but I think we are as objective as it gets, because we're not tied to any one single provider, and we can actually give people our subjective opinion.
Yeah, I think it's always important to look at your own situation, right? So there's many indicators out there that you can use to see where things are going, but you need to start with your own cost of mining and your own efficiency and see where you can improve.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you cannot improve if you cannot find a cheaper place for your miners and you're near your break-even point, then you should consider upgrading your fleet. And it doesn't mean that you need to sell everything and buy all new machines. You can also do it gradually. So.
Yep. All right, Nico, what more do
all
we
right,
have?
All so, right, so that's it. This is where you can find me. I have my website, digitalminingsolutions.tech, where you can find all the articles that I write. And on Twitter, you can follow me. Let me see how I stop sharing.
You recently revamped your website and relaunched as well, right?
Yeah, so I used to publish my newsletter on Substack, but I decided to bring it closer home, let's say, and publish everything on my own website, so it drives traffic to my website, mm-hmm. and people can see my other services that I offer. So
all right,
that's the reason why. So if you're looking for those articles, they can be found on the website.
Nico, we'll have you back for Q2 2024 to have a brief look at what happened. It's going to be very interesting after the halving. I concur with a lot of the stuff that you said, and I think it's really especially interesting to see how the situation in Paraguay develops. Maybe we can look back on that, and then also how much Bitcoin fiat price actually outpaces hash rate. We're over time. Nico, thank you so much for being on. I'll see you again in a bit.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation.
In a bit. Guys, if you learned something new, you know what to do. Leave a subscription and a like on the video, Swan, and I will appreciate it. Next Sunday, mining talk again here on the channel. And until then, I wish you a pleasant week. Let's see what the Bitcoin halving has in it for us. Cheers, guys. Bye-bye. Bye.